If you like football, you have Coach Paul Brown to thank. Here's what Bill Belichick, this century's most successful coach, has to say about the man.
Paul Brown, the greatest person in professional football. 95% of everything that we do, from scouting players to breaking down film to on the field teaching, everybody's still basically doing the same thing.
Paul's got a lot in common with Bill. The prickly personality, the obsessive nature, even the monotone voice. Here's about all you'll get from Paul on the secret to his success.
I'm primarily a teacher, and I think a coach has to be a teacher.
That lack of personality, along with the passage of time, may help explain why today most football fans, heck, even most Browns fans, don't know much about the guy.
Is he the reason they are called the Browns?
Didn't he coach the Browns, like back when they were good?
Paul Brown? He was that old dude that rocked the fedora, right?
The truth is, even after 40 years of living and really mostly dying with Cleveland sports teams, I didn't know much more than that. But an article on the early Browns by Barry Shuck gave me a new lens to view my ill-fated fandom. You know, finding out that the Cleveland Browns were once as dominating and hated as those old Yankees or the modern-day Patriots, and understanding the innovations that made that dominance possible, well, it made me think differently about the place that I'm from and maybe even about myself. And the more I learned about Paul, the all-time forgotten giant of sports and the father of modern football, a man much more interesting and fragile than his voice indicates, well, the more I realized that his story had to be shared, particularly today, as the Browns, after decades in the dark, now appear poised to return to relevance. And dare we dream dominance? I am Greg Babb, and this is The Miracle Man of Massillon, the cold, deadly, brutal Paul Brown. First, let's get the details about his early life out of the way. Born in 1908, Paul grew up and played football in Massillon, a steel town just outside Canton. That's where the great Jim Thorpe first popularized pro football, and where a league known today as the NFL was formed way back in 1920. In other words, Paul grew up in the best possible place to learn about the game of football. And he must have learned something, because despite his slight build, Paul was a very successful high school and college quarterback. Paul studied law but didn't want to become a lawyer, so after graduation in 1930, he became a teacher at a small Maryland prep school, where he also assisted athletic director Bill Hoover. When Bill got cancer, Paul took over the football team, and really, Paul just took over football. How'd he do it? Well, Paul played the fastest kids rather than the strongest, transformed practices from fun, intra-squad scrimmages into a study of structured choreography. He took over the play-calling duties from the quarterback. When you think about it, he domesticated a wild game, transforming football from a casual, chaotic pastime run by the players into an orchestrated art form conducted by the coach. And right off the bat, his very first season with this unremarkable group of boys, it works. Oh yeah, Paul leads his team to an undefeated season and wins the state championship. The accidental football coach has invented Moneyball and is well on his way to becoming emperor of football. Naturally, Paul was very proud of that achievement and was disappointed that the school didn't recognize his efforts. But as it happened, the Massillon Tigers that he'd quarterbacked in high school, well, they'd fallen on hard times. And Paul's former coach, now retired, convinced the school to give the job to the kid. At Massillon, Paul Brown was a man on a mission. As he explained in his 1979 autobiography, he scouted kids all the way down in elementary and middle schools, testing boys' speed and smarts with 40-yard dashes and IQ tests. Now, smart kids should know their assignments, but to be sure, and as we quote Paul, we're going to let him speak in a voice that better expresses the force of his conviction.
We also started the idea of playbooks in Massillon. I wanted the player to see the play, learn it, diagram it on paper, learn it physically, and do it until it became rote.
And the coach's control over his players didn't end when practice was over.
There was no smoking or drinking at any time, in or out of season. And anyone who violated those rules was automatically dismissed from the team. During the season, we allowed no riding in automobiles, going to dances, or dating. Every player had to be in home by 9:30 and in bed by 10 o'clock.
Now, someday I'd like to explore the possibility that the Great Depression was caused not by the stock market crash, but by the nationwide spread of Paul's team rules. Well, those rules worked. The Massillon team that, without Paul, in 1931 had won only two games, quickly became the 20th century's most dominant high school football team. From 1935 to 1940, playing the best teams in the state in the heart of football country, Massillon took home 5 state championships and 4 national championships. During those years, Massillon won by an average score of 40-3. In fact, their only loss during that time came when the whole team got the flu. And when the 1940 Massillon squad got the chance to scrimmage against the Kent State University Golden Flashes, Paul's kids shut out that college team 47-0. Along the way, Paul also convinced the city of Massillon, population 26,000, to build a 20,000-seat football stadium. And by the way, I'd like to know what the other 6,000 people in that town were doing every Friday. The city, of course, named the stadium after Paul Brown, who became known around the country as
the Miracle Man of Massillon.
But Paul had a bigger dream. He wanted to coach Ohio State University badly. In fact, so badly that Paul would sometimes drive to Columbus, walk into the empty football stadium, sit on the bench, and imagine what it would be like to call a game there. You know, totally normal behavior. Well, in 1941, the university was looking for a head coach, and there was a massive statewide campaign to get Paul the job. And once he was hired, do you suppose that Paul embarked on a listening tour to gather outside perspectives?
At Ohio State and everywhere else I coached, students and alumni had to absorb all my beliefs. From the start, I set out to convert everyone to my ways.
And Columbus actually turned out to be the football nirvana that Paul had always imagined.
In those years, playing football for a university like Ohio State was a happy, wholesome experience for the boys. The commercialism that we have today did not exist. Players were not given full scholarships, room and board, and spending money. Instead, they worked for everything they received.
As you'll see, those attitudes regarding player rights, well, they've become a growing source of tension as the years passed. But 1941 was a great year for Paul and his Ohio State squad, which lost just once to Northwestern on a last-second pass by a fella named Otto Graham. The next year, Ohio State won its first national championship, and Paul basked in the fans' embrace.
I'll never forget our student body chanting, "Our man is Paul Brown! Our man is Paul Brown!" Thundering down from the student section of that magnificent arena, it would stir me so much that I was ready to get into the game with our kids.
But President Roosevelt had other plans for Paul's kids. Most of the boys on that championship team were drafted and shipped off to Europe. Paul's 1943 team was made up mostly of 17-year-olds, mixed in with a few college-age military rejects. Even the Miracle Man discovered that there were limits to his powers. In fact, his baby Buckeyes, they only won 3 games. Naturally, of course, Paul, recognizing the importance of the war effort, took the setback in stride, right? Again,
My sense of justice and personal pride rebelled at these inequities, and I didn't spare the university president my feelings.
How did that feel, Paul?
I got the feelings, I got the feelings.
As if that wasn't bad enough. Well, Paul got word that he too was about to be drafted into the war effort. So, with a promise from the university president that he could return to Ohio State after the war, he enlisted as an officer and was assigned to coach a Navy team in Chicago. His military rank ensured he was still the man in charge. So much so, in fact, that when Paul smelled alcohol in the breath of 2 players during an early practice, well, he cut them and put them on a plane to Europe the very same day.
I can't help but wonder if those kids made it through World War II alive. And I really wish I could just go back in time and warn them. Respect Paul Brown's team rules! While Paul's Navy team did well against top colleges, the coach's mind was still back in Columbus, where his replacement, former assistant Carol Widows, who was no longer restricted to playing baby Buckeyes, had just completed an unbeaten season of his own.
I began to wonder about my position at Ohio State and called the university president seeking assurance. You're welcome to return, he told me. We made an agreement and we'll live by it. I needed more than that. I needed to be pampered a bit and told I would truly be welcomed. Somebody had to say, gee, we're really looking forward to getting you back. No one said that, however, and it only added to my hurt feelings.
I got hurt feelings. I got hurt feelings.
See, didn't I tell you he's fragile? Those hurt feelings came at an opportune time. While the NFL champion Cleveland Rams, oh yeah, City of Champions, were trying to relocate to Los Angeles, Chicago Tribune editor Arch Ward, great name, was trying to start a new professional football league called the, are you ready for this, All-American Football Conference, which to me sounds like four random squares on a sports league name bingo card. But anyway, in search of investors, Ward reached out to a wealthy Clevelander who'd already attempted to purchase the Rams, Arthur B. McBride, known to all simply as Mickey. Now, Mickey'd made his fortune in the newspaper business, starting off as a newsboy at age 6 and then working his way up the publishing empire of William Randolph Hearst. In 1913, Mickey was named director of circulation for the Cleveland News, and it wasn't a marketing job. No, back in the 1930s, and you're just going to have to trust me on this, a circulation director organized and armed young toughs to fight rival gangs for control of city street corners. Yeah, I know. Anyway, with the money he earned in that rough business, Mickey bought a lot of real estate in Chicago, in Florida, and in Cleveland, along with the Yellow Cab Taxi Company, which would later play a role in another one of Paul's innovations. Mickey jumped at the chance to buy a franchise and reached out to a Cleveland sports writer for suggestions on a coach. Naturally, the sports writer recommended he hire Paul Brown, but Paul turned him down flat.
I had no interest in professional football at that time, and Cleveland had a bad reputation as a professional sports town.
Come on, Paul. Cleveland was the 6th largest city in the country. Well, undeterred, Mickey asked Ward to visit Paul and kind of grease the wheels.
He played to my ego, and without actually realizing it, he started me thinking that perhaps I should think of coaching where my talents would be appreciated and I would be welcomed.
Then Mickey closed the deal with a stunning offer. And remember, this is 1945, and Paul is a first-time pro coach for a team and a league that don't even exist yet. So here it is. A $25,000 salary, a 5% ownership stake, 15% of all team profits, a stipend for as long as he remained in the Navy. Sounds like the 12 days of Christmas. But according to Paul,
as was the case at Massillon and Ohio State, the money was secondary. Most important to me, I had total control over the team's operation with total freedom to sign players and coaches.
And Mickey McBride turned out to be the perfect owner for Paul.
I told McBride that I wanted to build a dynasty from the start, and that I wanted our team to have the very best of everything, the players, coaches, and equipment, regardless of what it cost.
Mickey complied, and better still,
never interfered with anything I did, and in fact, I rarely saw him.
The All-American Football Conference didn't have rules on how teams should be formed. There was no draft, no salary cap. In fact, the only restriction was a 36-man roster. While Paul was still coaching in the Navy, he hired assistants to start assembling his Cleveland roster, and this was over a year before league play even started. Paul's Navy officer rank provided Cleveland with a huge advantage. With access to all the military personnel records, he could locate any man in the service and dispatched his assistants overseas to sign dozens of NFL players in combat. Their NFL teams had naturally assumed those players would return once the war was over, but Paul figured any player whose contract had expired was fair game.
We got into some conflicts with the Bears, the Chicago Cardinals, and the Cleveland Rams. The most interesting case came when some of the Rams players refused to play in Los Angeles, arguing that their contracts had called for them to play with the Cleveland Rams. The judge upheld the players' position, and we got to keep some fine players.
Along with the veterans he stole from the NFL, Paul also tried to sign the best players he'd ever come across during his time at Massillon, Ohio State, and the Navy. Those players included future Hall of Famers like quarterback Otto Graham, receiver Dante Lavelli, and kicker Lou the Toe Groza. The Cleveland football team now had the players, but still needed a name.
So Mickey offered a $1,000 war bond to the winning entry, and a young sailor submitted the name Panthers.
Now, the Panthers hadn't played since 1933, when their owner, Charles Zimmerman, simply ran out of money and left his team stranded in Philadelphia. So instead of paying Zimmerman money for the name, Mickey put Paul in charge of another Name the Team contest, this time offering a new car as the first prize. And at least according to Paul,
the contest lasted for some time, and because I was well known from coaching at Ohio State and Massillon, it turned out that my name, or Brown's, appeared more often than any other.
There are a lot of versions of this story, and I suppose Paul's is as believable as any. But ponder this for a moment. You're starting a new franchise, and you say to yourself, hey, let's name this whole thing after the guy who happens to be coaching right now. That'll make sense in 50 years. By the time training camp started for the inaugural 1946 Browns season, Paul and his assistants had signed far more than the 36 players that were allowed on the roster. Since most of those players already had NFL experience, the competition at training camp was fierce. And it got even fiercer when a week into training camp, Paul decided to integrate professional football. This was actually a year before Branch Rickey brought Jackie Robinson to Brooklyn. As the coach said,
there was no rule against it.
Paul first signed Bill Willis, a defensive lineman he'd coached at Ohio State. When hotels didn't allow Willis to share a room with his white teammates, Paul looked up Marion Motley, his former Navy fullback. Motley was already 26 years old and working at a Canton steel mill to support his family. And like Willis, Motley was bigger, stronger, and faster than everyone else, as difficult to tackle running the draw play as he was on the receiving end of a screen pass. In fact, he averaged a record 5.7 yards per carry over his career and 13 yards per catch. He also happened to be the league's best blocker and an all-time teammate. Paul had worked awfully hard to acquire all that talent, and he didn't want to give any of it up. So he approached Mickey with an idea to maybe have him hire some of the extra fellas to work at the Yellow Cab Taxi Company. The players didn't do much driving, but every day at noon, a line of yellow taxicabs pulled into League Park so they could practice with the team and take over if there was an injury. Thus was born football's first taxi or practice squad. Again, in a league without rules,
there was no rule against it.
That first Brown squad was made up of men Paul could easily mold.
They'd been in a war. This was a picnic after what they'd been through.
In his annual training camp address, which became known as the speech in which players were required to memorize, the coach once again insisted that his rules be followed on and off the field.
We don't want thug football players. I'll take my players high class, cold, deadly, smart, hard-hitting, and hard-running. You will dress and act like gentlemen at all times. When you travel, you will wear suits or sport coats and a tie. There will be no foul language at any time on or off the field.
Basically, the players had to be exactly like their coach, even in the dining room.
We will eat together and say grace before meals. There will be no t-shirts allowed in the dining room, and we have no use for ill manners at the table. Keep your elbows off the table and your face out of the soup bowl. Make meals enjoyable and take your time.
Speaking of time, Paul thought there was a time for everything. Why, according to Otto Graham,
Paul Brown told us your sex life is such that after Tuesday night, you should refrain because you save your strength for the football game.
Those weren't Paul's only words of warning regarding women.
Keep your wives out of our football. Don't have your wife talk football with other wives. It breeds trouble.
Some wives probably thought, why don't you keep your football coach out of our marriage? But hey, at least Paul let him marry. Remember, the Massillon players hadn't even been allowed to date. Paul was obsessed with eliminating not just problems, but errors. To make sure players didn't get complacent, he reviewed the tape of every game and had his coaches grade every player on every play.
It's detailed scientific study. The pictures never lie.
Paul hired scouts to watch upcoming opponents to learn their tendencies and then pre-scripted the first 20 plays based on those tendencies. He sent his assistant coaches up to the press box, which offered a better view than the sideline, so he could make in-game adjustments based on their insights. 70 years later, this is exactly what teams still do today. And all that maniacal attention to detail, well, it paid off.
The camera highlights in the world of sports.
Paul Brown's Legion of Doom vanquished the hapless Miami squad 44-0 before 60,000 in League Park.
Max Speedy and Dante Lavelli each caught 2 touchdown passes and Cleveland scored 51 points in a rout of the Chicago Rockets.
No Bob Feller, but Cleveland still pitched a shutout against New York's football Yankees in the house that Ruth built. Footballing Brooklyn Dodgers looked like those familiar bumps falling to Otto Graham of the Mighty Browns 26-7.
In a late season matchup against Miami, Willis and Motley weren't even allowed to play because of Florida segregation laws, but the Browns allowed just 8 yards rushing in a 34-0 rout. Spoiler alert, you're going to be shocked to hear that the Browns won the 1946 AAFC Championship.
And as the cheering thousands stood to honor the Browns, the players hoisted their great coach on their shoulders and carried him in a triumphant march off the field. The Cleveland Browns won the All-America Conference Championship and established many new records in professional football.
That they did. The Browns came back to win the championship in 1947, 1948, and 1949. They had the league's best offense, the league's best defense, and even the league's best kicker in Lou Groza. Over those first 4 seasons, Cleveland scored twice as many points as they gave up, winning 50 games and losing just 4.
The Miracle Man of Massillon
was now, well, he was now the most famous coach in America.
Paul, this is your old pal, Jimmy. I just wanted to congratulate you on winning yet another championship. Hell of a job, old man. You know, I used to be a pretty fair flanker back in my day, if I do say so myself. So if old Lavelli goes down, will you just give your old pal Jimmy a call on the blower?
But Paul wasn't without his detractors.
The New York media became frenzied and emotional because they weren't used to seeing their teams beaten with such regularity by a new college-like team from Middle America. They couldn't understand my intensity for winning or my insistence on a precise and strict method of doing things. As a result, we suddenly became the Big Bad Browns and I was the cold, deadly, brutal Paul Brown.
The Big Bad Browns created another problem, too. Once fans realized that no team could compete with them, people stopped coming to the games.
It seemed through most of the 4 years that instead of talking about our football, we were always apologizing for the tattered state of the league or how much money we were losing or about our uncertain future. This bothered me, and I knew it bothered our players.
Yes, for years, NFL officials had been using the press to diminish the Browns' accomplishments. In fact, Eagles coach Earl Greasy Neal was quoted as saying,
"Now, the NFL's worst team could defeat the Browns at any time and in any season."
Now,
You don't suppose Paul took that personally, do you?
No one in the NFL knew it, but anticipating the merger, we had been preparing for the Eagles for 2 years. Whenever possible, we had scouted their games and studied films we had received from various sources. Every so often, we would take in some of our practice time to experiment with some of our ideas, and by 1950, we had a pretty good idea of what we could do against them.
Are you following this? Paul is spending his free time figuring out how to beat a team he can't even play. I mean, just wow. Well, when the poor All-American Football Conference finally folded after the 1949 season, the Browns did join the NFL. League schedule makers were anxious to put Cleveland in its place, so they sent the Browns to Philadelphia in Week 1 to face, of course, Greasy's Eagles. The Eagles had won the NFL championship in both 1948 and 1949, so the Browns-Eagles matchup was billed as the game of the century. In the days leading up to it, Paul posted unflattering news articles on the team's locker room bulletin board, giving birth to a now common motivational tactic.
We were so ready. We were foaming at the mouth almost. We were ready to play that game. And we went in there, and of course, we killed them.
Yes, they did. Otto Graham threw for 346 yards and silenced a record 85,000 Philadelphia fans in a 35-10 massacre that would have been much worse if officials hadn't called back two Browns touchdowns on phantom penalties. That night, as the Browns sat in an airplane on a Philadelphia runway, the air traffic controller told the pilot, "You're clear for takeoff. Get those f***ing Browns out of town." Equally magnanimous was Eagles coach Greasy Neal, who complained after the game.
"Now, Paul Brown would have made a better basketball coach, because all they do is put the ball in the air."
Now, naturally, Paul took that barb in stride, right? No, actually, that comment bothered Paul so much that during the grudge match later that year with Neal's Eagles, he didn't call a single pass play during the entire game. Now, somehow, the Browns still won the game 13-7, but take a moment to reflect. Paul Brown wasn't content to win the game or even to dominate. No, even as he's desperate to win the NFL championship, he had to prove that Greasy Neal was wrong. That whole season, the Browns took an us-against-the-world mindset. They kind of had to. The NFL was so determined to prove its superiority, the teams openly shared films and tips on how to beat Cleveland. But the Browns just beat them all, winning the 1950 NFL championship over the now Los Angeles Rams, whose coach Sid Gilman said,
"Paul Brown didn't invent the game of football. He was just the first one to take it seriously."
And Paul forced everyone who wanted to compete with him to take the same approach that he did. Now, unlike the old All-American Football Conference, the NFL actually had roster construction rules. The Browns could now only acquire college players through the draft. And Paul was absolutely shocked by the lack of preparation that other teams put into such an important event.
"Some teams made their selection from a copy of a football magazine. We startled everyone by walking in with our notebooks listing each player by position and in order of preference. The next year, there were quite a few notebooks at the other tables."
Paul continued to refine his systematic approach to scouting college players. Now, regarding physical conditioning,
"I also told our scouts, whenever possible, to make sure they saw the player stripped so they could check his muscle and bone structure. The best example was Warren Lair. He didn't look like much in street clothes, but his tremendous body just rippled. Marion Motley took one look at him naked and laughing said, 'I don't fight no man until I see him stripped.'"
You know, that rule has actually kept me out of quite a few fights. Well, at any rate, with these methods, or just maybe pure luck, the Browns kept acquiring Hall of Fame players. I'm talking Doug Atkins, Art Donovan, Willie Davis, and Len Ford, a defensive tackle so quick and powerful that opponents actually had to double-team him, allowing Cleveland to pioneer the 4-3 defensive alignment that remains the standard today. Though the team was playing as well as ever,
Paul was alarmed by changing player attitudes.
A festering mood of selfishness had infected our team by 1952, fostered by some players who were reaching the end of their careers and wanted to get as much money for themselves as they could, and supported by others who put money ahead of their team.
Paul couldn't believe the drastic steps that some players took just to earn an extra dollar.
Speedy and his lawyer walked into my office, and the lawyer did all the talking, telling me that Mac was going to the Canadian League. I stood up, held up my hand, and said, "Good luck, Mac." We shook hands, and that was the last time I ever saw or spoke to him for 25 years.
So long, Speedy. Well, around that same time, when the great Marion Motley, as intelligent and dedicated a player as Paul had ever coached, was ready to retire, he asked about a coaching job. Paul responded that Motley should look for work back in the Canton steel mill he'd plucked him out of back in 1946. Okay, now I've got hurt feelings.
I got hurt feelings. I got hurt feelings.
But there was one aging player Paul couldn't live without. Quarterback Otto Graham. Paul had already created the passer's pocket, which is that cup shape that offensive linemen form around the quarterback to shield him from defenders. But it wasn't always enough.
The worst moment occurred against San Francisco. A 220-pound linebacker steamed into Otto Graham and smashed a fist into his face. It happened right in front of our bench. The brutality of the act momentarily stunned our players, and they almost lost control with anger.
At halftime, to protect Graham, Paul invented the face mask, which he patented and licensed to a manufacturer.
Soon every team used it.
And soon Paul earned a fortune off the royalties. The franchise's first real hiccup came when Mickey McBride, Paul's perfect owner, got into some trouble. The Browns owner had invested in two mafia-run publications, as well as wire services that provided sporting results to bookmakers. Mickey was indicted, though never convicted, for his role in these businesses, and the NFL became uncomfortable with his growing association with gambling. So in 1953, Mickey sold the team for $600,000 to four local businessmen, who not only quickly affirmed that Paul Brown would remain in charge, but also increased his ownership stake. Even with this change in ownership and the retirement of Marion Motley, well, the Browns, they just kept right on rolling. After winning the championship again in 1954, Paul convinced a beaten-up Otto Graham to return for one last season, which ended like every other in those days.
And Otto Graham ends his long and illustrious career, one of the most spectacular in football history. Cleveland defeats Los Angeles by a resounding 38-14 score.
So at this point, here's the tally on Paul's Big Bad Browns. That's 10 seasons, that's 10 championship games, and incredible 7 championships. They had no equal on the football field. But I've got a bone now to pick with the NFL. When the Browns came into the league in 1950, the NFL refused to count Cleveland's All-American Football Conference wins or the stats they accumulated during those games. For some reason, they still don't count. But I'm making the call right here, right now, they count. I mean, come on! The Browns dominated the NFL, who ultimately placed 13 people from those early Browns teams into the Pro Football Hall of Fame! If you're gonna pick on a team because of the level of competition they face, can we talk about the modern-day Patriots, who get to play the Jets, the Dolphins, and yes, the Bills twice every year? Gotta let it go. Time to get off the soapbox. Let's return to 1956. So yes, 1956. Paul now had to face his biggest challenge yet, and that was life without Hall of Fame quarterback Otto Graham. Paul had to rely on some guy named George Ratterman. So Ratterman was a great prankster in the locker room?
Someone was always getting hot stuff, a jelly that contained medicated heat for sore muscles in his jockstrap, which burned like fire.
But Ratterman wasn't such hot stuff on the field. So Paul was intrigued when two local engineers approached him with a remote control radio receiver, which they'd installed inside a helmet. That would enable Paul to give tips to Ratterman right up until the snap. Paul decided to try the contraption in a game against the New York Giants. But for once, his big idea completely blew up in his face. You had poor Ratterman spinning around on the field, struggling to pick up decent reception with his helmet antenna straining to hear Paul's play calls through static and scattered news broadcasts.
Three stabbing victims were rushed to Presbyterian Hospital after a madman let loose at Westside Market.
Meanwhile, Giants coaches Vince Lombardi and Tom Landry knew about Paul's scheme and kept their radio tuned to the Browns' frequency, which they'd gotten from the FCC. With knowledge of what plays the Browns were going to run, the Giants nearly killed Ratterman before Paul scrapped the experiment altogether. The NFL commissioner quickly outlawed the practice. That first season without Otto Graham, Paul endured his first losing record since the days of the baby Buckeyes. But finally armed with a high draft pick in 1957, Cleveland chose fullback Jim Brown, who many still consider the greatest ever. In 1957, Jim was named Rookie of the Year, led the league in rushing, won the Most Valuable Player Award, and led the Browns back to the championship game, even as the Browns shuffled through, yes, count them, 13 different quarterbacks in an effort to replace the eminently replaceable George Ratterman. But off the field, Jim represented Paul's greatest challenge to date, because Jim Brown was part of a new generation of players who hadn't been in the military and didn't see the sense in Paul's rules. Jim bristled under the strict thumb of his coach, whom he referred to as Little Caesar. And a note here, this is well before the fast food pizza chain came into being.
Pizza, pizza.
Despite Jim's production, Paul didn't care for Jim and devoted many pages of his autobiography to trashing the NFL legend.
We had to intercede with the law on his behalf because I seriously considered trading him because his outlooks and attitudes, I could never excuse his lack of effort in blocking. Until Jim came to the Browns, we never had any black-white issues or attitudes, and that this resentment touched everyone with whom he came into contact.
Well, whether the problem was selfish players, poor quarterback play, or maybe a coach who was losing touch with his players, the Browns couldn't make it back to the championship game, even with the 1-2 punch of fullback Jim Brown and lightning-fast halfback Bobby Mitchell. Despite whispers about Paul's old-fashioned tactics, no one on the team had the guts to challenge him publicly. That all changed in 1962, when 35-year-old New York advertising executive Art Modell decided he was tired of producing decorating programs on TV and wanted to get into the pro football business. When he arrived in Cleveland to try to buy the Browns, Modell sounded something like this.
Welcome to hell.
Okay, that may be a bit of projection on my part. We don't have an Art Modell autobiography to work with because, let's face it, the man was functionally illiterate. Sorry, tough memories for me with this guy. Let me try to locate a faint whiff of journalistic integrity here. He actually sounded a little more like this.
I wanted that franchise so badly, nothing would deter me. The ownership group said $4 million. I said it's a deal. I didn't have 4 cents.
According to Paul, Modell actually had $28,000, though for what it's worth, Modell says that Paul Brown's autobiography is libelous trash. Anyway. Somehow, Modell cobbled together the rest of the $4 million through outside investors and lots and lots and lots of loans. I mean, imagine walking into a car dealership with enough money to buy a Kia Sorento and walking out with the car dealership. Modell worked with Paul's lawyers on an 8-year extension worth nearly $700,000. That contract ensured Paul's continued control over football operations, a point that Modell emphasized during his first press conference.
As far as I'm concerned, Paul Brown can send in the plays by carrier pigeon.
It was a different story once the two started working together.
The owner immediately called dibs on the coach's large corner office, attended and often halted practices to chat with individual players, and even dared to criticize the coach on game day.
That's no way to play winning football. Go for the scoring bomb. Throw the long pass.
By day, the never-ending barrage of curses from Modell's office caused Paul's longtime secretary to up and quit after a few months. And at night, the young owner would often hit the bars in search of players he could ply with drinks so he could find out what they thought of Little Caesar. Modell was the Jerry Jones of his day. That is, if Jerry Jones had a Brooklyn accent and $28,000 to his name. He'd just bought a great brand and needed to turn that brand into cash so he could pay off his debts. As self-appointed head of publicity, Modell developed close relationships with the media, hired marketers to churn out daily propaganda, and arranged radio interviews for Jim Brown and quarterback Milt Plum.
In direct violation of my rules, which encourage them to be openly critical of the team and the coaching, the complete control and authority I'd once held over them had worn dangerously thin.
So Paul was stuck with Modell, with Jim Brown. He also wasn't sure what to do with halfback Bobby Mitchell, who had a military commitment that kept him out of practices. Plus, Cleveland Stadium's notorious turf neutralized his effectiveness late in the season. Well, over in Washington, D.C., team owner George Marshall was under order by the Kennedy administration to finally integrate his team or risk losing his stadium lease. Marshall thought it was all quite unfair, complaining to the press,
"All the other teams we play have Negroes. Does it matter which team has the Negroes?"
Well, with the worst owner in football, it only made sense that Washington had the worst record in the league and thus the first pick in the draft. Relenting to Kennedy's demands, Marshall was prepared to select running back Ernie Davis, nicknamed the Express, a Jim Brown clone and the first black player to win the Heisman Trophy. Which would have been great, except Davis had a better offer from a team in the competing American Football League. That provided Paul Brown with the opportunity to swoop in with a solution to all of Marshall's problems. Bobby Mitchell, stationed near Washington, meaning he'd be able to attend practices. And besides, Mitchell would be the perfect person to integrate Marshall's team.
Marshall knew that Bobby was a class person, very intelligent and low-key.
All that's missing from that coded description is the phrase well-spoken. Well, anyway, in return for Mitchell, the Browns got the rights to sign Ernie Davis, who now had leverage over Modell to negotiate a record $200,000 contract. In Washington, Bobby Mitchell became a Hall of Fame wide receiver, and in Cleveland, Ernie Davis became a pawn in a three-man power struggle. Paul had traded for Davis without telling Modell in the hope that he could one day trade away Jim Brown and all of his problems. Jim knew it and Jim resented it. It was particularly tough on Jim because he knew Ernie Davis. He knew him well, had recruited Davis to follow him at Syracuse University. Jim knew that Ernie Davis had something that he lacked.
See, the great thing about Ernie is that he brought people together. He had that kind of spirit.
Of course, Modell was furious that Paul hadn't consulted him, regardless of what that contract said. So Paul's secret trade for Davis united Jim and Modell in opposition to Little Caesar. Here the story turns from bad to much worse. Ernie Davis complains at a college postseason All-Star game that his gums are bleeding. He's taken to the hospital and diagnosed with leukemia. Modell actually seems to take the news harder than Davis, says it's like somebody struck him with a knife. Modell flies Ernie Davis to Cleveland to be examined by doctors, more doctors, crackpots, anyone who might change Davis's prognosis. But it's clear he's going to die soon. Which is a horrible shame because, well, not just because Ernie Davis was young and he would have been one of the great all-time running backs, although he was and he would have been, but because you get the sense from those who knew him that he might have become a transcendent figure during those tumultuous years. So anyway, back on the football field, with the 1962 season about to start, the quarterback situation completely unsettled and injuries all over the offensive line,
Art Modell projects nothing but confidence.
I guarantee we'll win the championship.
But the team gets off to a shaky start. Even the great Jim Brown is struggling, due in part to an injured wrist and another problem.
Part of the reason was his freewheeling attitude of independence fostered by his relations with Modell.
Meanwhile, Ernie Davis, entering a period of remission, told Modell that he wanted to experience the joy of playing football again. So the owner insisted that Paul allow an emaciated Davis to practice, and it just unnerves his teammates.
Sometimes, when he walked onto the practice field, they looked at him and everything got very quiet. It became just heartbreaking.
The owner kept pushing Paul.
Finally, Modell came to me one day and told me, "Put him in the game and let him play. We have a big investment in him and I'd like a chance to get some of it back. It doesn't matter how long he plays, just let him run back a kick. Let him do anything, just so we can get a story in the paper saying he's gonna play and the fans will come out and see him. If he's gonna go, why not let him have a little fun?"
Now, given Modell's depth of feeling for Davis, I'm guessing he would dispute Paul's characterization of that conversation. In any event, with the backing of team doctors, Paul didn't relent. Ernie Davis never played in a game. He would pass away after the season. In fact, the whole team came to the funeral. But from Paul's point of view, rock bottom came in December, when the team was stuck in an airport in Sacramento waiting for the fog to clear. One of Paul's assistants ran up to him from the airport lounge, all out of breath. He couldn't believe what he'd seen. Modell was buying players drinks. Yet another violation of the sacred team rules. I mean, come on. Alcohol?
That was the final straw. The last vestige of anything I had ever stood for was destroyed.
Under these trying circumstances, Paul thought he'd done a heck of a job to finish above 500. Jim Brown felt otherwise.
The game was passing Paul by. And the politics were passing him by. I'm guilty of being one of the guys that related that to Art.
And for Modell's part,
it was getting awkward. The relationship was non-existent.
A long, almost six-month-long newspaper strike gave the media-savvy Modell the perfect opportunity to quietly remove the legend and take control of his team. Here, in fact, is the full text of Modell's grand announcement.
Paul E. Brown, head coach and general manager, will no longer serve the team in those capacities.
For the coach, the greatest indignity came the next day when he found a box with his personal belongings on his front porch right next to the morning paper.
The message was very clear. Don't come back to the office. So ended 17 years of my life.
To replace Paul, Modell chose soft-spoken Blanton Collier, who was the team's running back coach. Collier was partially deaf, which may explain why he was more tolerant of outspoken players. While Collier empowered the players, Paul stewed.
Those first few cruel months after I was fired, I felt like Napoleon on the Isle of Elba.
He remained part owner of the Browns, and in fulfillment of his huge contract, he served as scout, identifying, among others, star receiver Paul Warfield. Warfield actually managed to revive the team's passing attack, and the Browns won their last championship in 1964 in a shutout over the Colts. Modell felt vindicated.
One of the great Browns teams of many years, if not of all time.
Paul, on the other hand, was slightly less effusive in his praise.
I must admit that the success of the team gave me the feeling of at least leaving the Cleveland scene without the stigma attached to a loser.
The Browns remained a contender for another 10 years, but never again won a championship. Modell was forced to continually funnel the team's earnings into debt management rather than scouting or player salaries. Not surprisingly, the team had a series of poor drafts and lost players in ugly contract disputes. The empire was clearly crumbling. Emperor Paul Brown returned from the Isle of Elba in 1968 when he was offered a franchise in Cincinnati by the rival American Football League. As the team's owner, general manager, and head coach, he was right back in his comfort zone with complete control.
though this time he was without the advantages that allowed him to build a dream roster in 1946, Paul wasn't ready to concede defeat.
We may be an expansion team, but we aren't going to be the Foreign Legion.
Following a league merger, the Cincinnati Bengals entered the NFL in 1970. Paul couldn't wait for a revenge against Art Modell and those Browns. For him, it was 1950 against the Eagles all over again. In fact, it sounds crazy, but Paul actually called a regular season victory over Cleveland that year the sweetest satisfaction of his entire career.
One of my friends later told me that I looked as though I were 18 years old the way I ran off the field, and I told him that's exactly how I felt. I confessed to having tears in my eyes when the players handed me the game ball.
Aw, finally a band-aid for all those hurt feelings. The Bengals won their division in 1970, and by 1975, the Bengals were 11-5 and primed for sustained excellence. But Paul was starting to feel a little out of place in the modern NFL and maybe in the modern world.
I continued my practice of taking players to a movie the night before a game, a policy I started back in Massillon, and sequestering them in a hotel as I started doing at Ohio State. In the 70s, the choice of movies became a little skimpy for my taste, and when I complained publicly, a local theater owner in Cincinnati provided us with some private showings of decent movies.
We have no word on whether the players enjoyed the Apple Dumpling Gang. Facing a hostile media, increasingly powerful player agents, and challenges from an upstart World Football League, Paul decided it was finally time to retire from coaching. With the opportunity to choose his successor, he bypassed fellow innovator Bill Walsh, the heir apparent, in favor of loyal longtime assistant Bill Johnson. While Johnson quickly washed out of football, a frustrated Walsh took the Ohio River short passing offense that he and Paul had invented back in Cincinnati. He took it with him first to Stanford and then to San Francisco, where he and a quarterback named Joe Montana perfected what would become known as the West Coast offense. Together, they won 3 Super Bowls, 2 of them against Paul Brown's Cincinnati Bengals. Bill Walsh is just one notable disciple to rule the NFL. In fact, Paul Brown's coaching tree includes legends like Don Shula, Chuck Knoll, Weeb Eubank, Tom Landry, Bill Belichick, who spent his early summers at Paul Brown training camps, and, oh yes, a total of 26 Super Bowl wins and counting. Meanwhile, back in Cleveland, Art Modell continued to borrow big money, generate big headlines, and make terrible football decisions. The team's fortunes changed in the late 80s when, sparked by imports from the collapsed United States Football League, and yes, if you're scoring at home, that's the 7th professional football league we've referenced in this episode, the Browns had a revival, but those teams are best known for their heartbreaking playoff losses. In 1991, Modell hired a driven young innovator named Bill Belichick to rebuild the franchise from the ground up. The team was a contender again by 1994, but Modell, already famous for firing the world's greatest football coach, managed to fire Belichick too and devastated Cleveland fans in 1995 by moving the team to Baltimore.
If I didn't move my team to Baltimore, my family would have gone into bankruptcy. You declare bankruptcy in the NFL and it's automatic revocation of your license.
Touched by Modell's financial plight, Cleveland fans made sure he knew there were no hard feelings.
But by the end of the game, entire sections of bleachers got torn apart and heaved onto the field.
As Modell, Coach Bill Belichick, and son David Modell were hung in effigy, hundreds of Browns fans gathered in downtown Cleveland to watch the hanging at high noon. It gave fans a chance to vent pent-up hostility towards the Browns owner.
Modell never stopped trying to repair the relationship with Browns fans.
I know I broke their hearts when I moved, but it wasn't my fault. I couldn't get the Johns to work in the upper deck.
To which Browns fans responded,
"Go to hell, Modell! Go to hell! Go to hell, Modell!"
Under pressure from irate fans, the NFL forced Modell to leave the Browns' history and name back in Cleveland, where Brown had once been synonymous with excellence. Modell did take with him former Browns tight end Ozzie Newsome, who became the Baltimore Ravens' general manager and used the draft to build a consistent winner. Bill Belichick managed to find work with the New England Patriots.
Though Belichick and Newsom never took Cleveland to a Super Bowl, the pair led the Patriots and Ravens to a total of 11 championship games, winning 8 and just beating at least the pro record of the late great Paul Brown, who died of pneumonia in 1991. A few years after his death, the NFL finally caught on to one of Paul's more novel ideas. Today, every pro and college football team relays plays to the quarterback via radio signal. The Ohio River West Coast offense that Paul developed with Bill Walsh back in Cincinnati is still a foundation of NFL offenses. Paul's charismatic son Mike took over the Bengals and has tried his darndest to carry on the family legacy, though with mixed results.
We've had a difficult year. Everybody feels it. We know the dissatisfaction. We're unhappy with ourselves. People are unhappy with us.
The Browns returned to the NFL in 1999 as an expansion team, though they haven't enjoyed the same level of success as Paul's Browns. In fact, Cleveland fans have had a lot of reasons themselves to be unhappy. But that's a story for another day. This podcast was written and directed by me, Greg Babb, and produced by Keith Marsteller. Voice talents by Marsha Marsteller, Will Burton, Paul Catalano, and Keith Marsteller. Theme song and score by me, with apologies to Flight of the Conchord for use of their great song Hurt Feelings, and a movie tone for their newsreel theme. Special thanks to Barry Shuck for inspiring this episode with his article on the founding of the Browns, and to PB, the Paul Brown story. Sources also include NFL Network, ESPN, Cleveland Press, Cleveland Plain Dealer, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Washington Post, Dogs by Nature, New York Times, Sports Illustrated, The Shadow League, and The Washingtonian. This has been a Dumpster Fire production. Thanks for listening.